The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
It's nice to see you all. So I've been doing a number of talks on views. This is the fourth talk. This will be the last one in this series. So what do I mean when I say this word, views? I mean stories, beliefs, opinions, viewpoints, ideas. It's kind of like this, our views, the kind of the maybe our worldview in which we are looking through and we understand our experiences, or maybe our view is something that we create based on our experiences. So we all have them. We all have these beliefs, these views, opinions. And when we see them in ourselves, we seem to be perfectly natural, based on experience, based on fact. And of course we have these ideas. Of course we have these opinions. Often when we see them in others, though, they seem a little bit idiosyncratic. Maybe it's unproven or silly or narrow-minded or something when we see them at other people, even though they maybe have come to their views, their opinions, their beliefs in the exact same manner in which we came to ours, that is, based on our experiences that we've had. For the most part, our beliefs, our views, our opinions are unexamined, and we've inherited them from our other people, our families that we grew up with, or from the larger culture or society. And they may be based on circumstances or based on experiences that are no longer relevant, or they may be perfectly relevant and appropriate. One thing about our beliefs is that they really, whether we recognize them or not, really underlie our actions. Often what we're doing in the world, whether it's behavior, activities, or mental actions, our beliefs really have a large impact. In fact, they can determine our values, what we think is important, what we think is not important, what we tend to be dismissive of, and what we tend to privilege. Our beliefs give birth to our goals and our aspirations. And they also guide our choices when we find ourselves in morally difficult situations, unsure of what to do. Some of our underlying ideas, really, we can see what's important to us, what our beliefs are when we find ourselves in those situations. And one thing that I emphasized in an earlier talk is about how, of course, we all have beliefs, views, opinions, but one thing to look at is our relationship to them. That is, are we holding on to them very tightly? Or are we holding them with more open-handedly? Do we have this feeling like this is true and everything else is wrong, untrue, false? Or this is my current thinking. This is what makes sense to me right now. So we can look at there's these two extremes of holding on really tightly and the extreme of letting go, letting go, letting go. But most likely, all our views are along a spectrum. There's maybe some we hold tightly only in certain situations. Maybe some we hold so tightly that we don't even recognize it as a view. It's just the way that the world is. It never occurs to us that it might be, that it's possible to be different, and that we might be basing our interpretations on opinions or beliefs, assumptions that we might have. Probably many of you know that one of the key teachings in the Buddhist teachings is that clinging, that is holding tightly, is not the way to freedom, is not the way to greater peace and ease. It's the way to unfreedom, bondage, suffering, discomfort, stress. And so there's a lot of teachings about how to let go of about clinging, including a clinging to philosophical views, Buddhist doctrines, Buddhist teachings. Ideas that they're helpful as long as they're helpful. We don't hold on to them just for the sake of holding on to them. We hold on to them so that they can be useful and supportive and nourishing. When they're no longer supporting our practice, supporting our movement towards greater freedom, greater ease, maybe we can soften any amount of clinging we have. Maybe they will let go through attrition. One of the pitfalls of holding on to views tightly is that some sincere inquiry into like what's really happening, and sincere inquiry into the teachings, inquiry into our practice, kind of falls by the wayside as soon as we think that, well, I already know. Many of us have probably heard this, the title of this book by Suzuki Roshi. It just slips my mind. It's probably Zen mind, beginner's mind, or something like this. Yes, you're shaking your head. Thank you. It's pointing to this idea that, right, when we think that we're an expert, when we have all the answers, then we're no longer really present with what's happening. And there may be a lot of pressure to really hold tightly to particular views. Maybe it's a way that prevents us from looking at what's uncomfortable, what's we don't feel quite ready to see, or that says something unflattering about ourselves. So there may be a reason. There may be some real pressure to hold on to particular views because it prevents us from doing something that's uncomfortable. And not only that, if we're really holding to our views, it can lead to conflict. We start to feel like if this is true, but in order for this to be true, it also means that all these other things are not true. And we feel compelled, we feel this pressure to support, to bolster, to prop up our views. Somehow that means that we have to denigrate or dismiss or somehow prove that everything else is wrong and is false. These create the perfect conditions to be in conflict with other people. The perfect conditions to be in conflict with ourselves, perhaps. Perhaps we have conflicting views and that don't quite make sense, or to be holding both of them. So one way then to work with conflict when we find ourselves in conflict is to have this gentle inquiry. Well, what is the view that is supporting this conflict? What is it? Is there a view of mine that's being threatened, that's being questioned? And as a consequence, do I feel threatened? Do I feel like I need to really hold on to this view because somebody else has something different and it just makes me feel uncomfortable? But our practice, our mindfulness practice, is a big part of it is bringing a spirit of curiosity, inquiry, investigation to what's really happening. This includes what our views are, what beliefs are happening, maybe why we're thinking what we're thinking, not in terms of some psychoanalytic way, but just a gentle inquiry, like what's underneath this? What's fueling this? And with this gentle inquiry, we might discover that our views maybe aren't as constant. Maybe there's sometimes we hold on to them more tightly, and then other times we're a little more open-handedly. Maybe we discover that underneath them there's particular experiences that are supporting them, supporting having these views. And I'd like to talk a little bit more about that this evening. What are some of these experiences that really support beliefs, really support the creation of views, opinions, assumptions, stories? What's underneath it? Where do they begin? If we can say they have a beginning. So in the Buddhist scriptures, in the suttas, there's this well-known sutta that's in which the Buddha outlines 62 different philosophical views, metaphysical views, or views about metaphysics, about the cosmology and what happens, what's the nature of the world, is it eternal? What's the nature of the self, is it eternal? And it goes through and kind of systematically gives, you know, there's people who believe this, there's people who believe that, this long list, 62 things. Reading the sutta seems to go on and on and on. Views about the past, views about the future, views about what's happening right now, including what's described as eel wigglers, people who don't say they have any view. They, when you try to pin them down, they slip out and say something else. I love that expression, eel wigglers. Slippery. So after this long list, and this description of 62 types of views, the Buddha, he doesn't say that any of them are wrong. He doesn't give a 63rd view that's correct, according to him. Instead, he states that he has perfect peace because he has truly understood the qualities of sensations. His perfect peace because he's understood the qualities of what we can say, we can use the word Vedana, the Pali word. Sometimes it gets translated as feeling or feeling tone. It's risky to translate it that way because feeling, we automatically start to think of emotions, sadness, happiness, gladness. That's not what's being pointed to here. Vedana is the affective tone, the quality. Is it pleasant? Is it unpleasant? Is it neither pleasant or unpleasant? So in response to all these different views, the Buddha says, I have perfect peace because I've understood the nature of Vedana, the quality of Vedana. I interpret this, when I read this, I feel when he's saying, I have perfect peace, he's highlighting the agitation that's associated with holding on to views and espousing these views and getting in debates with other people, getting in conflict with other people about them. And other places in the suttas, he describes how a wise person just doesn't bother with that. A wise person is holding everything with open-handedly and isn't grasping, clinging, not even to views, doctrines. Also talking about Vedana brings the, and the Buddha saying that he has understood Vedana, is it brings the whole topic away from philosophies, ideas, opinions, and it brings it right into our immediate experience. Something completely different than being busy with the mind, It's like, well, right now I understand that there's a pleasant sensation. Over here, I understand that there's a unpleasant sensation over there. Very different. We see this a lot, kind of this rhetorical strategy of bringing something completely different than what we're expecting. After this long list of views, we're expecting, okay, well, what is the right one? And instead, he's pointing towards our experience. So, to say a little bit more about Vedana and the guided meditation, I pointed us to pleasant, unpleasant, and neither pleasant nor unpleasant. And that's one way we can think about it, as three distinct categories, three buckets, that all of our sensations, all of our experiences, whether they're bodily or mental, or mental, bodily, we could say come in three flavors: chocolate, vanilla, strawberry, pleasant, unpleasant, neither pleasant nor unpleasant. We can also say, well, maybe it doesn't make sense to have these three distinct buckets. Maybe it's just all a spectrum. Things tend to be more on the pleasant side, maybe strongly so, maybe subtly so, or maybe on the unpleasant side. And maybe there's this big range, or maybe a small range, in which they're neither. We often use the word neutral for those ones in the middle. One thing that's interesting about Vedana is it's associated with every single experience, without exception. Everyone. So, as I said, mental or physical. So this means that if we wanted to, if we chose to, that we can make this, whether something is pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, that the object of our meditation, as we did earlier. I'll talk about a little bit more about that in a moment. But it also is the case that we only experience one of these flavors of experience at a time. A moment, maybe it feels like a micro moment of pleasant, and then a moment of unpleasant, and then a moment of pleasant, and then maybe neutral, and then pleasant, and then unpleasant, and then neutral, pleasant, 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 unpleasant, neutral. Whatever it might be. If we pay attention to them, and you might have noticed this, that it's always changing. And most often, or we would say technically, they're associated with the senses. Visually seeing something, hearing something, bodily contact, taste, and the mind meeting a thought. We could think about that. And that we don't control it. Of course, we all wish that we were having pleasant. Well, I think maybe we don't wish that, but most likely we have a preference for pleasant, but we can't just control it, right? It's arising based on the sense contact, the contact with what's coming in through the sense doors. And what's important here is that Vedana, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, has a giant impact on our views. Maybe you did this too when you were young, or maybe you did this with your children. That I remember doing this when I was young. That with the help of my mom, that we made a sugar solution that I think it probably was boiled water, but lots and lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of sugar and more sugar. And then so that it's like this super saturated solution. And then when we put this in, my memory is of, we did add it like in a glass cup like this. And then we had a pencil that laid on top and then a thread that was hanging from this pencil. So the thread goes hanging down in the center of the cup. And then as the water cools, the sugar crystallizes around this thread. And you can pull the thread out and you have rock candy, right? This sugar, this crystallized sugar, and which was completely delightful when I was a kid. Like, wow, it's fantastic. A little science experiment at home that rendered some sweet candy. In the same way in which we put the thread into that super saturated sugar solution, and then there's these crystals of sugar that got created all around it, in the same way with Vedana, so a lot of views, all kinds of things can get crystallized around it. All kinds of things, but I'll use this word views, all kinds of other mental activity, I'll say that. When we were a kid, you know, we didn't care. We would just chewed on the sugar. We didn't care that it was not so good for our teeth or not so good for our nutrition. We just liked having that experience of having something sweet. And in the same way, we might be doing something similar here too. We might be experiencing a lot of views and not really recognizing that it might be bad for our teeth or bad for our nutrition and just really holding on to them. In a similar vein, we can think of the relationship of Vedana and views as if Vedana is a type of magnet and it just attracts kind of like views to it. It kind of like pulls in these little filings and they get glommed on. But of course, views also influence our reactions to Vedana. Views that we have influence how we respond when we are experiencing something pleasant, how we respond when we're experiencing something unpleasant, and how we respond to something neither pleasant nor unpleasant. So if we want to soften some of our views, unpack some of our clinging that we might have, that we might be leading us into difficulties or conflict or less freedom, we can work with Vedana. And we can work with this by just being mindful, bringing to mind Vedana. What is, as we did in the guided meditation earlier, maybe we can just pay attention, pleasant sensations, unpleasant sensations, those that are neither pleasant nor unpleasant. But why might we do this as opposed to paying attention to the sensations themselves or paying attention to the views themselves? One reason is that sometimes it's easier to have this very simple, we could start with a simple category. Is this pleasant or unpleasant? Maybe it's not clear, maybe it's somewhere in the middle, it's neutral. This is a way in which we can kind of simplify what might feel like a morass of experiences and mental events, bodily events. It's just really unclear. Maybe we could just simplify. Okay, whatever's happening right here, it's unpleasant. And maybe we can just, what does unpleasantness feel like? And somehow bringing our attention to that very simple, fundamental, basic experience of unpleasantness can thwart kind of more of this crystallizing of views around the thread. We can somehow kind of like, oh, okay, this is what's happening. It's a way that we can mitigate or diminish just more perpetual story making or more spinning out or feeling really uncomfortable, feeling confused, like, oh, this is unpleasant. And just land there. Land with this is unpleasant. And then you might notice that just the landing on that kind of a label or landing on that clarity of like this is unpleasant, the experience of landing has a little bit subtle of a pleasant sensation. Like, phew, okay, well, I know I'm here. I'm here having an unpleasant sensation. Oh, but wait, that's a little bit pleasant to have that recognition. And then maybe it's unpleasant again. So that's one reason why we might want to bring our attention to the Vedana. Another is that we might gain some self-understanding. We might notice that when something unpleasant is arising, we find ourselves lost in fantasy or memories of pleasant experiences. Kind of just check out and try and desperately try to find something pleasant if we're experiencing something unpleasant. Or maybe if something is really pleasant, we find ourselves trying to figure out, how can I prolong this? How can I keep this going? Maybe with neutral experiences, we discover, well, I don't really have neutral experiences. I can't find them. Maybe we distract ourselves whenever we find something neutral, so there really isn't anything neutral. It's usually either pleasant or unpleasant. But just to learn something about our habitual reactions, what we're doing to different families, different flavors, different types of experiences. Another advantage of bringing to Vedana is that this is maybe something that we can bring in our daily life. When we're busy, and rather than having the trying to find the subtleness of what exactly our emotions are, or the subtleness of some other sensations, maybe it can be obvious. This is pleasant, it's unpleasant. We can do this while walking around, in conversations, driving, whatever it might be. Maybe we could simplify it to only three choices. And that might be something that can kind of bring us back to the present moment. And of course, working with Vedana, working with sensations, is a way that can help undermine some of our views. Help undermine some of the story making, the beliefs that we tend to hold on to that may or may not be serving us, supporting our search for a greater freedom. So if we find ourselves with unpleasant sensations, there's a number of ways we can work with them. One is, if the mind is kind of quiet and we're feeling settled, is just to notice, oh, that's unpleasant, and then move on to whatever the next sensation is. Don't have to make a big story about it. We don't have to make it a problem. We don't have to try to shift it. It's one way, just to notice. The second is, if the unpleasantness is really strong and really compelling, find a really unpleasant sensation in the body, for example. Sometimes we can zoom out. Often when there's unpleasant sensations, we tend to kind of collapse around it, and that's all of our awareness becomes just about what's unpleasant. I get into our loop about having the sensation, I don't want to have this sensation, how can I make it go away, and when is this going to end? And our whole awareness gets to be around that sensation, our reactions to it. So if we can zoom out, we can notice, okay, there are some other sensations happening in the body also. We're not trying to pretend that this unpleasant isn't there, but we could also notice that, okay, well, I can also feel the pressure of the chair, the cushion, the ground. I don't know if that's pleasant or unpleasant or neutral, but it's another sensation. I can also notice the sensation of the air conditioner. That might be unpleasant, it might be pleasant, it might be neutral. But just to zoom out, to notice that there's a collection of experiences. Maybe it's unpleasant, unpleasant, pleasant, unpleasant, unpleasant, neutral, 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 unpleasant, pleasant. Instead of, we tend to kind of collapse around and think that everything is unpleasant. So that's one thing to do, is to zoom out and notice what other sensations, what other categories of sensations are happening in succession, one after another. If the unpleasant sensation is not so strong, maybe it's just like an itch or a little bit of a pulling or stretching or something like this, maybe a little bit of dryness of the mouth, for example, maybe you could stay there and hang out with it for a little while. And just have a gentle inquiry. Are there any views that are getting activated? Are there any views that are getting reinforced? Are there any views that are getting created related to this unpleasant experience? Examples might be. And, you know, largely these views are, we're not aware of them. They may be completely out of our awareness, or there might be a tiny little whisper of them. But there might be something about, you know, life is about pursuing pleasure and staying away from unpleasant experiences. So if I'm having an unpleasant experience, it somehow means that I'm failing, that I am doing something wrong. And that can slide into I'm wrong or something. So that might be some reaction, like I'm failing, I'm not doing it right, whatever it might be. I'm not doing life right, I'm not meditating right, I'm not sitting right, I'm not thinking right, I'm not sensing right, whatever it might be. Or maybe there might be a view of, I'm going to stay with this painful sensation, and you know, I'm just going to dial it up a little bit and really get into it, because no pain, no gain. We might have this feeling that, you know, this is good for me. It's good somehow to have these difficulties, and spiritual practice is supposed to be hard. Or we might have this feeling that there's meaning somehow, or that it has a particular, that's a way to undo some other thing, whatever it might be, to be with, really be with painful experiences. There's a whole range of views that we might have that support our maybe being with uncomfortable sensations, or that get activated and created with uncomfortable, unpleasant sensations. They work together. Sometimes if a view is, if a sensation, maybe a thought one, is like, oh, that was a feeling I feel diminished somehow, then maybe there's, we feel like we have to compensate, and we are espousing our views even louder just to kind of overcompensate to make up for this feeling of having that uncomfortable sensation of feeling diminished or unseen or unheard. And that way, that uncomfortable sensation leads to our holding on to our views and trumpeting them. And not even really caring if these views are correct or helpful or true. We just want to be seen and heard and are doing this activity. But when we have unpleasant sensations, the task is, in this tradition, other spiritual teachings have other teachings. And in this tradition, the task is not to sit through excruciating pain. It's not ennobling. You don't ennoble yourself just to sit for pain for the sake of sitting with pain. The task is to learn, investigate, be curious, maybe stretch your capacity to be with things that are uncomfortable. But can you see the impact that uncomfortable sensations have on the mind? Can you see the impact that the mind has on uncomfortable sensations? Can you learn something about yourself? I've had some experiences happen on some of these longer retreats it's quite astounding. I kind of surprised myself by having this idea, like, wow, if the mind wasn't still, if I hadn't been on retreat for all this time, if the mind weren't as still, I would have a completely different reaction to this sensation. So can we notice how different mental states that we have influence the way that the Vedana influences our views? And the way that views influence Vedana, and Vedana influences views. So what about pleasant sensations? Many of us prefer comfort and have this kind of pursuit of pleasant sensations. But when we start to pay attention, we start to notice that, well, these pleasant sensations, they if we have them, there's a little often of fear, a little bit of tension, like, oh, this is going to end. What can I do? I don't want this to end. Or this little, tiny, very subtle, sometimes fear of what's going to happen when this ends. So we become averse to the ending, which, of course, is another form of craving. So we get this craving and pleasant sensations in just this loop that doesn't end. More craving, more pleasant sensations, craving not to have the end of these sensations. And we keep on pursuing pleasant sensation after pleasant sensation after pleasant sensation unendingly. It's quite something. If you ever look at this, how we're always in pursuit of this. Often because we don't know any other escape. We don't know what else to do. We can look at some of the views we have related to Vedana. Whereas Vedana may lead to some craving, which then leads to this view that I need this, I have to have that. It's very, very important that things be in this particular way. And if they're not, and it's not, I can't be with it, I can't, it's not acceptable. So that's why kind of pleasant sensations might influence those particular views. And in the same way, views we might have regarding pleasant experiences, we might have this view, well, pleasant experiences have no place in an honest spiritual practice. In another setting, I was teaching about happiness and the role of happiness in spiritual practice and finding our way to greater and greater freedom. And this was, I was teaching about the suttas. So it was showing where the happiness shows up in all these different places and all these different settings. And one of the students was like, are you sure like happiness is supposed to be part of this practice? It doesn't, I had no idea that was even allowed. I thought we were just supposed to sit down and shut up and be quiet. But maybe we might have this idea that we shouldn't be having any pleasant sensations. But we can recognize often when the mind quiets down, there can be a sense of relief, like, and there can be some pleasantness associated with that. As I mentioned earlier, there can be some pleasantness of just noticing this is unpleasant, this is pleasant. Just the noticing can bring a little, like, ending of confusion or bring a little bit of clarity, and that can have a subtle but quiet, pleasant quality to it. In practice, the question becomes not so much, is it, should I not have pleasure, or should I have pleasure? The question is really about, does it bring greater freedom? Does it support greater peace? Whether the sensation is pleasant or unpleasant, and the reactions we have to it, does it lead to greater or lesser freedom? So is the opposite of freedom suffering? And then I'd like to say a little bit about neutral, neither pleasant nor unpleasant sensations, because this is a really rich place in which views get born. Because it's views as a type of distraction or entertainment away from something that we think neutral is somehow just not interesting, is boring. We're so often, I have this idea that things need to be stimulating. Certainly Madison Avenue wants to convince us, the advertising industry, that things should be energizing and uplifting at all times. And in order to do this, you please purchase this and purchase this and purchase this. Kind of this idea. We might have kind of like somehow internalized this idea that life should be stimulating, uplifting, energizing. And when we find something that's neutral, we just feel like, oh, that's boring. And we tend to be dismissive, and or we'd want to make it not no longer be neutral. Want to bring in drama. Maybe it's subtle drama, but maybe it's drama nonetheless. Drama in terms of having a strong reaction, this is intolerable. Or maybe drama in terms of arguing, it's just coming up with, this is wrong. It shouldn't be like this. It should be different. Or maybe there's we can add some excitement, some humor. Or we can add some bodily activity, doing something. Anything except feeling this kind of neutral, either pleasant or unpleasant experience. And our views, we can create them, or the ones that we have habits to, can provide some of this entertainment, some of this distraction, some of the commentary that is necessary to heighten kind of our emotional responses, to get us out of these neutral sensations. So the practice here is, can we turn towards things that are, we kind of think are uninteresting? Can we bring interest to the uninteresting? Can we be curious about? Can we investigate what we think is boring? But boredom is kind of a lack of intentional focus. Boredom is just staying on the surface and not really being connected more deeply with what's happening. It can be a defense mechanism, a way that we just don't really want to see what's happening, so we tend to just like, whatever. It's boring. But can we have some curiosity and ask, what's getting in the way with really connecting here? What's getting in the way with really being with our experience, this experience that we think is boring? After all, sometimes boredom is actually can be the seed for creativity. Having the mind kind of quiet and not busy, new ideas, make space for some room for something different to come in. And maybe when things are neither pleasant nor unpleasant, it's an opportunity to just hang out with things being very simple. And maybe things are kind of subtle. Maybe there isn't a level of intensity that matches our preference or matches our usual experience, but just to practice being with things that are simple. We might have to develop a taste for simplicity. Maybe we are so used to things being complicated, multifaceted, fast-moving, whatever it might be. But Dharma practice moves us in this direction towards greater and greater simplicity. Moves us to softening our views, letting them kind of arise, pass away. Moves us towards being more toward what's actually happening, as opposed to these really complicated stories, philosophies, opinions, ideas. Because excitement is temporary and requires a lot of effort to kind of like stay excited. We always have to kind of like be turning up the dial in order to feel excited all the time. But if we can appreciate simplicity, the neither pleasant nor unpleasant, or maybe just quietly pleasant or quietly unpleasant, if we can appreciate the simplicity, can support some, not only creativity, but some further opening, some further understanding, some further spaciousness, and maybe undermine the creation of beliefs and views, opinions that we feel compelled to really hold on to and defend and support. So in this way, working with our sensations, vedana, whether it's they're pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, can be a way in which we can undermine our views, a way in which we can understand how our views influence our reactions to our everyday experiences, in a way that we can unpack and take some of the authority and the power out of some of these ideas that we have. I'm not saying that we have to get rid of all of our ideas. I'm not saying that we have to get rid of our opinions and views. I'm saying that the way to greater freedom and peace is to hold them open-handedly, is to hold them in a way that allows them to come and go, allows them to support us instead of to hold us tightly and without freedom, without peace. So I think I'll stop there and open it up and see if there are some questions or comments.
Hello. I have many disagreements with many things you said, but I'm trying to work my way through them. There is one, though, that I would like to share. While you are looking for peace and tranquility and all that, there are a lot of people who are doing exactly the opposite. And in the long maybe history, then they will things will get better. But usually, standing alone and finding peace doesn't make them stop.
That's right.
Their own thrive to do something else.
Yeah. I'm not saying that peace is passivity. I'm not saying that peace is tolerating things that shouldn't be tolerated. I'm not saying that peace is being silent. I'm saying that peace is having settledness, clarity of mind, openness. It can mean fierceness. It can mean activity, being in there saying for ourselves, saying these are boundaries, you've crossed these boundaries, that's not okay. It can be seen, this is not just what is happening out there, it's not okay, and doing something about it. And this is something that we can do. We can have some settledness, some clarity, some openness and some ease, and strength, fierceness, movement, setting clear boundaries. This is okay, this is not okay. Is that what you're pointing to? Yeah, and this way, right, if we have some openness, and I'm using this word peace, is then when people are push back, which they will, that's what happens. If we ourselves have some clarity and openness and spaciousness, then we can respond in a way that's wise. We can respond in a way that is fruitful. We can respond in a way that brings the greatest benefit, as opposed to relying on our habitual reactions, relying on our habitual way that we might close down when experiencing some pushback. If we have some ease, we're more able to hear and meet what's happening as opposed to collapse around it, or something like this. Okay, so it's 9:00. So I wish you all a wonderful evening. Thank you.